It's, sometimes leaving the traditional boundaries behind can be a little scary, or depending on your musical taste, a little annoying. Either way, sometimes, though, we have to be ready. We have to be willing to break from traditional boundaries and expectations in order to be able to be in step with the things that God is doing in our lives, to be able to break from what it is that are the cultural norms or even sometimes the religious expectations, to be able to find our way into God's plan, to see ourselves operating according to His purposes. This is something that we're going to look at a little bit this morning. We're coming back to our study in the Gospel of Luke this morning. So if you have a Bible with you, if you'll turn to Luke chapter 1. Luke is certainly taking his time setting the stage in this story. It's been 80 verses so far, and Jesus hasn't even been introduced yet, just his teenage mom. But as any good investigative report should do, he's making sure that we have all the background information in place so that we can see how the connection is made between the stories of the Old Testament that lead us towards the story of Jesus. As well as he's also showing how the life of John, the prophet, the forerunner of the Messiah, Jesus the Messiah, how those two stories interweave. They're not just two separate stories that got thrown together out of convenience, but God was in the process of the whole thing, putting something big together, something, a larger story that's being revealed. Now, we've talked about how God has defied the cultural and religious expectations so far in this story. I mean, from the places of origin that we have here, we've got, people from a nowhere town full of poor people, unknown people, a has-been, down on his luck priest and his wife, who wasn't able to have kids, strange, unexpected characters that begin our story here that God chooses to use in order to launch his invasion of the world. It's a strange thing. But that's the big idea throughout all of Luke's gospel, that God's got a destiny for the ones that the world would consider losers by all accounts. So far, we've met old Zacharias and his wife Elizabeth, who were told by the angel Gabriel that they were going to have a child when they were in their old age, this child was going to be the herald to the Messiah. Next we met, and remember that Zechariah, the old man, had trouble with that. And so God, took away his ability to speak for a time being. A corrective impairment was given to him. And then we've met Mary, a young teenage girl who's engaged to a local blue collar worker. And the same angel tells her that she's going to get pregnant, and miraculously so, because she's a virgin. And her son is going to be the Messiah. So these are the characters that we've met so far. Last time we looked at the meeting between the elder Elizabeth and the younger Mary, and we considered how revolutionary these events are that are unfolding and how they forecast for us what this gospel is going to be like. What our mission is actually all about. Now today we're going to pick up the story and we're going to see the same kind of unconventional events beginning to unfold here. So if you've got your Bible open to Luke chapter 1, we'll pick up in verse 57 where we left off. It says, "Now the time came for Elizabeth to give birth, and she bore a son, and her neighbors and relatives heard that the Lord had shown great mercy to her, and they rejoiced with her. And on the eighth day they came to circumcise the child, and they would have called him Zechariah after his father. But his mother answered, 'No, he shall be called Yohanan, or John.' And they said to her, 'None of your relatives is called by this name.' And they made signs to his father, inquiring what he wanted him to be called. And he asked for a writing tablet, and he wrote, 'His name is John.' And they all wondered. And immediately his mouth was opened, and his tongue loosed, and he spoke, blessing God." Okay, we'll stop there for a moment. As we can imagine, the whole town has heard what's happened to Elizabeth, as her, this woman who was childless, who was in her older years, she's become pregnant. And even though she would have been considered a high risk pregnancy, she safely delivered a baby boy. And babies have been born since time began. But there is always something wonderful about it. There's no way around that. You can get a room full of strangers, but you see a baby in the midst of that, and there's something about that. It thrills us as human beings. Baby dedications here are a time when, we can take the time to pray over and consider, corporately consider, the huge potential that resides in each of these children. And it's a wonderful event. And so you can understand how in a small community like these people were in, that a baby being born, and especially being born under the circumstances that it was born into, that this is a big event for everybody. Everybody's informed about it. Everybody's in on it. Everybody's excited for them all. Now, for the Jewish people, there are important mitzvahs that have to be fulfilled. A mitzvah is a command given by God. And there are important commands concerning children, especially male children when they're born. Leviticus 12 outlines the obligation of the parents to have their son circumcised 8 days after his birth. Now, circumcision is, you know what? I'm going to let you and Wikipedia have some alone time together and figure that out on your own if you don't know. But it's a Jewish custom that originated. God gave the command to Abraham, who was the father of the Jewish nation. And it's a ritual scarification of the male anatomy, which demonstrates a man's identification with his Jewish heritage and with God's covenant that he made with Abraham. It's kind of one of those things. It's not something that's applicable to the New Testament believer, but in those early stages when God was reintroducing himself to humanity, he needed to use the most graphic and most attention-getting things that he could do in order to get humankind's attention. And this part of the anatomy is something extremely special to men. And so it's one of those things. It's a constant reminder of God. So it's a big deal with the Jewish people. It really is. To this day, for Orthodox and devout Jewish people, this is important. Now, it tells us in the story, it says that they came to circumcise the child that Elizabeth had, and you have to stop and wonder, now, who's they? Who are they, and what's that all about? And we'd have to look to traditional Jewish customs that continue to this day, and as far as we can tell, they're continued uninterrupted and unchanged to this day, to understand what's happening here. They would be the family and the close friends of Zach and Beth, as well as someone called a Moel. It's M-O-H-E-L. But he's the person, he or she is the person trained in the actual circumcision itself. This is a ceremony called the Brit Milah, and it's observed by devout Jewish people to this day. All the close friends and the relatives of the family will come into the house early in the morning, and they do it early in the morning to demonstrate their eagerness to be able to obey God's commands. And the child is handed over to a person designated as the Sandek. And the Sandek is the person who's going to hold the child while the operation takes place. And the Sandek sits in a chair that is designated as Elijah's chair, which is really interesting, especially when you consider who this kid is that this ceremony is taking place for, the one who's going to fulfill the promise of Malachi, that Elijah will come before the coming of the Christ into the world. Now, the Moel recites a blessing over the child. Here's the blessing that he recites. Praise to you, Adonai, our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with your commandments and commanded us in the ritual of circumcision. And it's also part of the tradition at this point in time that they would bless a cup of wine. There's a few more things involved in it. And they would also name the child at this time. And the reason for that is that Abraham, the father of the Israelites, had his name changed from Abram to Abraham when he had this act of circumcision, when he fulfilled this commandment of God. And so from that point on, it's been the tradition that they name the child at the time of this ceremony. So they'd pray over a cup of wine, they'd put a drop of the wine on the baby's lips, and then they would pray this longer prayer that designates the baby's name. Creator of the universe, in your abundant mercy, through your holy angels, give a pure and holy heart to, and in this case it would be Zechariah, the son of Zechariah, whom we circumcise in your name. And it's at that moment, during this ceremony, everybody's quiet, everybody's serious. It's at that moment that Elizabeth suddenly bursts out and says, no! And you can just kind of imagine all the heads in the room kind of turning to her and looking at her and going, what do you mean? What do you mean, no? What are you talking about? And she says, I mean, his name is not Zechariah, it's John. And at that point, You can sort of imagine everything just breaking into pandemonium. I don't know if you've ever seen any of the Neil Simon plays about his childhood growing up in a Jewish household. Brighton Beach or whatever, and all the screaming and the shouting and the emotions and, oh, what are you talking about? There's nobody in your family named. What are you doing? You're trying to kill us. So why is this such a big deal at this moment? What's the big deal about the name? Well, we have to remember they have no other children. This more than likely is going to be the only son that they're going to have. This is the only one who's going to be able to carry on Zechariah's name. But it also means when you name a son in that culture, when you name a son after the father, it means he will walk in his father's steps. In other words, he would carry out his father's work as well as a priest. Had he been named Zach Jr., he would have been expected to grow up as a priest, just like dear old dad did, just like dear old dad before him and his dad before him. He would have carried out his priestly duties like the men of his family had done for generations. That's what was going to be expected of him in this. But again, we see the strength of the women in Luke's story, because here Elizabeth stands up to all of these people in the room and she defies all of their traditional expectations concerning this young man. Obviously, Zechariah told her what the angel had said to him when they had their meeting in the temple there, that the son's name is supposed to be John. God designated that. But nobody listens to Elizabeth in this. They don't consider her word on this to be credible. So they go to Zechariah for the tiebreaker. And you notice in this that in the text it says that they make signs to him to tell him what's going on. Now, nowhere so far have we ever heard that he's deaf. Now, maybe he is deaf, but it could actually be one of those things like, you know, because he's not talking, everybody assumes he can't hear too. So they're talking to him like he's an idiot and he's sitting there like we do when somebody... You meet up with somebody who doesn't speak English, and what do? You talk louder. Like, that's going to make it better. Or I watch that show Amazing Race sometimes, and it's hilarious to me how people will be in a foreign country, and they're trying to communicate to somebody who doesn't speak English, and they'll put on an accent. Like, as if that's going to somehow help. Oh, yeah, now I understand you. I just needed to have more stereotypes, and now I can get it. But anyway, Zechariah, he sides with his wife, and as soon as he does... He can talk again. As soon as he does, all of a sudden his mouth is loosed from this restriction that God had allowed on him. And once again, we see here that Luke's characters are breaking with the normal protocol. We've been noticing that all the way through this story. We're so familiar with it. It's a Christmas story. It's so traditional to us and filled with a lot of traditions. And yet, the whole thing about this story is it's breaking with traditions. It's throwing things upside down. The gospel just seems to defy social conventions, no matter what context we seem to find it in. And as we look at this baby and his parents who were faithful to follow God's leading and calling and not cultural expectations, we can actually gain a little bit of insight about ourselves. We can actually look at our own journey with God and glean something from that. And that is, God's purpose in our life is not confined by tradition. And we always want to keep that in mind, especially as it touches our journey with God, and especially as it touches our relationship with church and Christianity as we've always known it. Tradition demanded that the child be named after his dad, and tradition had defined his identity and his role in life. Tradition would have had his whole life figured out for him, but God had something else in mind for him. This isn't to say that all traditions are bad. This isn't to say that there's something evil or inherently wrong with tradition. Tradition's a wonderful thing. We got Christmas trees, we got Christmas traditions all around us. But what's wrong is if we allow tradition to begin defining us. There's where we've got a problem. And that's what we never want to allow to happen. We don't ever want to let cultural or religious tradition define who we are or what we can do in God. I mean that seriously. I mean, people will say all kinds of things because of what the traditional expectations are for us in our roles in life. Well, I can't be a leader because I'm a woman, or I can't present an idea for worship because I'm too young, or I can't be relevant because I'm too old. Really? Really? I mean, does God ever say that somewhere? Does God ever define things that way? Not at all. What does God say? It doesn't matter what the traditional expectations are or the definitions are that try to hold us back. If the gospel story tells us anything, it shows us that we need to find out what God has in mind for us, and traditions can be damned. Well, you can't say damned in the pulpit. We don't even have a pulpit. We got this thing. Tradition says that we can't haul couches into the main room either. Tradition tells us we can't wear flip-flops when we worship, or if you're going to have a real church, you're going to have a membership role. And we don't have any of those things, and yet God seems to show up here on a pretty regular basis, doesn't he? So we don't have to worry about those things. What does God have in mind? What does God have in mind for you? What's he doing in your life? What's happening in your life? I mean, you might think, well, that doesn't seem very normal. Well, that's okay. That's been God's MO all the way through this story. God's not really that concerned with normal at all. And we'll find that more and more as the story goes on. And we also don't want to let not just the religious expectations, but the culture. We don't want the culture's traditions to define us either. We don't want to be coerced into believing that we're only as valuable as what we own or what's in our bank account, or if we even have a bank account, because the culture will try to dictate that to us. God's purposes in our life are not confined by those things, not at all. What we have to do is seek to discern what God has in mind for our lives, and then don't let anything hold us back. If it's in compliance with his word, and his word as best as we can understand it, then go for it. If it's not going to violate our conscience or harm another soul, man, go for it. Don't let anything hold us back. You know, the other thing that's really interesting to me is the names that were at the heart of this controversy here. They wanted to name the baby Zechariah, which means literally God remembers or God remembered. But God wanted to name the boy John, which means God is gracious, or God's grace is being demonstrated. One name was actually pointing to the past, and the other was pointing towards what God is doing in the present. Zechariah was almost a picture of Israel at that day, looking back at the past, pining away for a memory of what Israel used to be like. Mute, no prophets were speaking in the land at that time. It was all focused on stuff that was long ago, stuff that God did a long time ago, and they were hoping he would remember it and hoping he'd repeat it. But John comes in as a herald of a new age, and his name declared God's work of grace in the present moment, in the present time. And it may be a stretch, but I think names are significant in the word, and it makes me think about how God's work in our life is not past tense, but it's ongoing in the present. God's work is ongoing right here, right now, as we're gathered here today. It can be a real temptation for followers of Christ to bog down looking back instead of looking around. Because, you know, when we first get saved, you know how that is. There's an excitement that surrounds that. There's such a newness to it all. It's such a huge buzz. It almost lifts us off the ground. And everything we do or say or experience seems to have, seems to be absolutely loaded down with significance on all levels. And it just feels like God's all over us all the time. But, you know, over time, the process of the journey sort of settles us into our walk, and we can start looking back at that initial stage and sort of pining away for that. So start looking at that as though that was the big thing that God did in my life. And from here on, I'm just kind of on my own. From here on, I've just kind of had to figure things out as I go. It's not been like that. And sort of wishing for those old days when it used to be different, when it used to be like that. And subtly, Christianity starts to become a historic interest for us instead of something that is currently at work in our lives. We start reminiscing about the good old days when we first got saved, or those good old days when God's work seemed so much more evident in my life, and we miss what God is doing right here and right now because we're busy looking backwards. See, that's the nature of this gospel story. God is doing great things. Sometimes they're happening in small ways, and as we move along in the journey, things take some time for us to see and recognize. But even in our dark moments, what we don't want to do is look back to the past and say, oh man, you know, things used to be different that way. What we want to do is look around and say, where is God at work in this? It's not a matter of saying like, where's God, like he's abandoned us, but where is God? Because he's somewhere in this. Somewhere in this, God is here. God is going to meet with me. God is doing something to enable me or to give me a coping life. We want to embrace what he's doing in the present, not relegate everything to the past. Okay, so Zechariah says his name is John, and suddenly he can talk, and we get to verse 65. It says, and fear came on all their neighbors. And all these things were talked about through all the hill country of Judea. And all who heard them laid them up in their hearts, saying, what then will this child be? For the hand of the Lord was with him. Okay, we'll stop there for a moment. We don't have time to really go into this in depth or anything, but I just want to point out that this part of the narrative reminds us that God's power in our lives is going to be noticed by others. And the reason I say that is because it's significant for us, especially as people who are by and large associated with evangelicalism. Sometimes we get so worked up wondering how it is that we're going to share with people, wondering how it is we're going to come up with the right things to say at the right time that's going to make everything click for the people around us so that they'll agree with us or believe like we do, as though that's our goal. And unfortunately, what happens then, when we get so wound up making sure that we've got the right thing to say or the right argument that's going to finally convince somebody, the result is that evangelicalism comes off, actually, as rather caustic or argumentative. And the reality is, that's never actually been our goal. That was never the command. We were to go into the world and make disciples, but we were to do it the way Jesus did it, by going out and living out the difference that's there. And so really the main way in which we're going to be able to share what we believe is by living out the reality of God's work in our lives, not just trying to convince somebody that we're right. And that doesn't go unnoticed when we live differently. We may think, oh, well, but you know, what good is that going to do? Well, when we allow the power of God to direct us, when we allow God to change the way we make choices or the way we react, so that it's different from the way the rest of the broken world reacts, that means something to people. It gets noticed, and God in the process is glorified. It made headline news back in 2006 when in Pennsylvania a gunman went into an Amish school. Remember that when that happened? And five little girls were gunned down. That made headline news. But you know what else made headline news that was equally as astonishing and alarming to everybody? That the Amish community gathered around the family of the shooter who had committed suicide, went to his funeral, and spoke nothing but words of love and forgiveness towards that man. That kind of thing is evidence that God is running loose through the world, that there's a love, that his love is more powerful than death. That's the sort of thing that causes the world to take notice, not just our attempts at arguing with people. And people can't help but notice that there's something odd, something different. Now, some people will complain about it, say it's an unrealistic view of life or whatever, but I'll tell you what, the peace and resolution that resulted from their reaction, as opposed to some of the things that we see when we look for an eye for an eye, I think it speaks volumes. Okay, so the story goes back to Zechariah. He gets his voice back, and suddenly he breaks out into a song. So, you know, here we got another song. Clearly Luke wanted this to be the musical version of the gospel, you know, sort of like Oklahoma or something like that. But anyway, so here we go, verse 67. I know, that was painful. That really hurt. Ow! That wouldn't even hurt. It reverberated all the way up here. Note to self, do not do that, second service. Okay, verse 67. And his father Zechariah was filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesied, saying, blessed is the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people, and he's raised up a horn, or the power of salvation, for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke through the mouth of his holy prophets from old, that we should be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show the mercy promised our fathers, and to remember his holy covenant, the oath that he swore to our father Abraham, to grant us that we, being delivered from the hand of our enemies, might serve him without fear in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you'll go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people in the forgiveness of their sins, because of the tender mercy of our God, whereby the sunrise shall visit us from on high, to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. Okay, this song here is traditionally called the Benedictus. It's the because of the Latin word for the opening, Benedictus Dominus Deus Israel, blessed be the Lord God of Israel. The song has two parts, verses 67 through 75, which talks about the work of the promised Messiah. That's what he's forecasting there, and that he's finally come to reveal God's power and favor for Israel and to deliver Israel from all of her enemies, fulfilling what God had promised to Abraham long, long ago. Now, this was the typical, as we've said before, this is the typical understanding of what the Messiah's work was in that time, looking for a revolutionary leader who was going to raise an army who would fight Gentile oppression and create the golden age of Israel. But the rest of the song, you know, he begins with that, but then the rest of the song, as he begins prophesying over his son, suddenly changes, and the wording begins to change. He talks about his son being the forerunner, the herald of the Messiah, and everything he says here, the language takes an abrupt turn. He speaks of salvation, of forgiveness of sin, of mercy, and light, and guidance, and peace, and we come away with a much clearer view of what the Messiah's mission is actually going to be about, is actually going to look like. And we see that there's a fusion that takes place in this prophecy that he says here. There's a fusion between the old expectations and the new reality that is beginning to unfold right in their midst that occurs in this song. It almost feels like the first half was written by an Old Testament saint. As you read that first half, it feels like an Old Testament prophecy. And the last part has such a strong New Testament feel to it that it's almost like this transition that takes place. He launches out from the stories of the old and the promises that God made in the ancient times that suddenly transforms and turns into this beautiful thing before him of mercy and grace. And it gives us that transition. It illuminates how God was going to go about demonstrating his power and his love and his care for his people, how he was going to redeem his people, and how it was going to include more than just the Jewish people. It wasn't going to be through the sword, but it was going to be his mercy and his love and his grace. The idea is a kingdom is coming. No doubt about that. And we never want to shy away from that reality. Christianity is about the kingdom of God. It is highly subversive in that sense. We are talking about a distinctly different kingdom than the kingdom of this world. That's why I'm not a political guy. You can't drag me into these things because I've got a king. I've got a king. And he's the one that I serve and I follow. And the kingdom that is coming isn't going to be like the kingdoms of this world. It wasn't a kingdom like Rome, who kept peace at that time through military domination, through the Pax Romana of the sword. It was going to be a kingdom, and it is a kingdom of love, which advances peace through self-sacrifice, through the example left to us by God himself. But it is highly unlikely that Zechariah understood all that when he was busting out a rhyme here. So he was just stoked that he had a son and he wanted to sing. But in retrospect, we can look back and see what God was trying to communicate to us through these things. Okay, finishing up here this morning, verse 80. It says, and this is where we'll stop today. It says, "And the child grew and became strong in spirit, and he was in the wilderness until the day of his public appearance in Israel." And I'll tell you, that last verse is almost anticlimactic to me. Do you feel that at all as you look at that? I mean, here we've got angelic appearances and miraculous births, and you'd think that we'd launch into some more miracles and cool phenomena, but instead we just sort of watched John grow up in one sentence and sort of disappear off into the scenery, off into the desert where he's hidden away for a while. There's no ceremony, there's no detail or anything like that. He just goes away. And I'll tell you, it's easy to read past verse 80 and launch into the next part of the story without stopping to dwell on this moment, stopping to consider and think about what this means. Time is going to pass here. Time elapses here in John's story. Time that for the casual observer would say, well, you know, nothing's happening there. That's that strange sort of pacing that God seems to like to employ, like that silence in heaven for the space of an hour, where it seems like everything just comes to a standstill for a moment, where everything builds up and then sort of dissipates, and you can almost get that unsettling feeling like everything fell apart, or you're kind of wondering, what just happened here? What was this all about then? Why is John way off in the desert and we can't see him? And we're tempted in those times to think that God's moved on to something else. that he doesn't care about this anymore. Or maybe we've missed him somewhere in the process. Maybe we don't, you know, see him, or we don't see much happening, or we don't know exactly what his plan or purpose is because we're out of step somehow. But this little sentence here in verse 80 reminds us that God's destiny for our lives is sometimes hidden from view. Now, this isn't to contradict what I said earlier, that others will notice what's going on. That has to do with how we're behaving and how we're living out the reality of the faith that we've embraced. But as it comes to our ability to discern God's purposes in our lives, as it comes to our ability to be able to navigate through all the different things that we face, we've got to remember this, that the God's destiny for our lives is not always necessarily out there in plain view or spelled out in a very orderly way. Just because John's in the desert doesn't mean that God isn't doing something great. Just because all you see when you look around is desert doesn't mean that God isn't working on something powerful and amazing. What answers to prayer are we looking for? What things are we anticipating that God is going to do that just haven't seemed to come to pass yet? What aspect of our destiny do we feel like is delayed in coming to pass or becoming clearer? And what do we do? Do we feel like throwing in the towel? Do we feel like, oh, well, that's it. You know, I'm done. I don't know what. You know, God's not answering me anymore. He's not doing anything. All I see is desert everywhere I look. But don't do that. We definitely don't want to do that. We want to remember that verse 80 is still here. With all of the amazing stuff we've seen in chapter 1 so far, we still got to deal with verse 80 before we go on to anything else, where John goes tiptoeing off into the desert and we don't get to see him anymore. We don't want to throw up our hands and say God's not at work. God's at work. It's just that sometimes he's working in ways that we can't exactly see what it is that he's up to. The fact is, we don't know, based on what we've seen so far, what we've read so far. Forget about what we know in hindsight because we may have read the story, but we don't know when John is scheduled to make his appearance. God didn't provide that in the bullet points as he was developing this story. We don't know when John is going to show back up again, but he will. He will. And it will have a profound impact on the world. We don't know when God's determined to show up in glory in our own lives, but he will. He will. Because that's his purpose. That's his goal. That's what he's doing in our lives, leading us towards that revelation of himself and that deeper relationship that we have with him. We really don't know what's going to happen in the next few moments. So how could we assume that God's no longer at work just because we can't see it? The future is completely unknown to us. We have no idea what's going to be happening in the next few. We've got to be so careful. See, we've got to be careful that we never try to define John by verse 80. We don't want to define John by his time out in the desert in terms of his purpose in life. That was just part of the story. And we have to determine not to define ourselves by what we can see happening right this moment, because it's just part of the story that's leading towards something else. Who knows what's going to happen? Does anybody here have any idea what's going to happen next? If you do, I want to hang out with you. But we don't know. None of us know. Nobody knows what's going to happen in the next few moments, the next few minutes, the next few hours, the next few days. But God does. And he's working in all of these things, working towards a good conclusion for all of us, working towards his glory being revealed in our lives in ways that we may never, ever have anticipated. God's doing that. So what do we learn here as we look at this story about John the Baptist? What did we learn? Well, we learned that God's purpose in our life is not confined to traditional expectations. Let's not allow the traditions, both of Christianity and of the culture that surrounds us, to begin defining us. Let's look for what God's doing in our lives and follow him that way. And God's work in our lives isn't just a thing of the past. It's something that's presently happening. It's ongoing. God's at work right here, right now in our lives. And God's activity in our lives as we are reacting to it and living out that reality is going to be noticed by the world. It will make a difference in this world as we live out the teachings that we've received from him. But we also realize that God's destiny for our lives is not defined by what we can see right now, that he's at work, whether we're feeling like we're in the desert or not. So those are the things that we can hold on to. This gospel story gives us a lot of hope. This gospel story is something that can encourage us and keep us sustained in the lives that we live, in our daily lives, day to day, week to week. Right on?
Right on.
All right, very cool. Well, if you guys will stand with me, please, and the band will come up here, and we'll close with a song. And as we're singing this morning, I want to remind you that Ruth will be over here. I haven't seen Blake. Is he here? But Ruth will be over here to... Is he here? Oh, there he is. Ruth and Blake are going to be over here to pray for anybody who may have a need. Man, make your way over to them and pray for, pray with them. And let's just see what God is doing in our lives as we bring these requests to him. So, God, we just thank you so much for the work that you're doing in our lives presently. We thank you for the gospel story, which reminds us that you care and that you're involved and that you love us. And I just pray, Father, that as we roll towards Christmas and all that's associated with that, that your grace is with us and that the reality of what this gospel being birthed in the world is demonstrated in our lives on a day-to-day basis. I pray that for all of us, Father, in Jesus' name, amen.
You give good gifts to me. I pray that I receive them well. So pass the cup of suffering and let the oil of joy be poured. I'll say, God.
Blessing on each other. May Christ be a light to illumine and guide you. Christ be a shield to overshadow you. Christ be under you. Christ be over you. Christ beside you, on your left and on your right, both in this world and the one to come. Go in peace, you children of God.